As many know, George Zimmerman is on trial in Florida, charged with murder in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, but also being judged the language being used by one witness. In fact, language has been quite in the spotlight this week. Here's Chef Paula Deen being asked on the Today Show about her acknowledgement that she used the N-word.
I don't know, Matt. I have asked myself that so many times because it's very distressing for me to go into my kitchens and I hear what these young people are calling each other.
So Paula Deen saying she's not sure if it's offensive, and as if on cue, one young person did use the N-word, Rachel Jean Tell, who was on the phone with her childhood friend Trayvon Martin when he and George Zimmerman got into that altercation. She said he used the N-word in quoting what Trayvon told her when he thought a man was following him.
And then he said, still following me now. Is still following me now.
Are you still following him?
Yes.
Lawyers then asked her what else Trayvon said.
I asked him how the man looked like. He looked like a creepy cracker.
Okay. Then what happened?
And then he said, still following.
And the defense team often said they couldn't understand her.
I had told you. You listening?
But last night on MSNBC, linguist John Wartner had this response.
She said in the clip that I had told you, and many people are thinking, why is she using the pluperfect? That's Black English. My cousins did that when I was little. It's the narrative pluperfect. Linguists talk about it. There's a dissertation about it.
Well, let's start there with John Rickford, professor of linguistics and humanities at Stanford University. Professor Rickford, so is linguist John McWhorter right? Is this a dialect?
Oh, yes. Yeah, John McWhorter, who was my student here at Stanford University, is perfectly right. And linguists who've been studying African-American vernacular English or Ebonics since the early 1960s recognize all the features in Rachel Gentel's speech. One that seemed to throw the court for a loop was the point at which she was asked whether she was, you know, now beginning to pay attention. And she said, I've been paying attention, sir, meaning I've been paying attention for a long time and I'm still paying attention. I'm not sure they ever really got that right. So she used a lot of the classic features of African-American English, which you can find spoken, especially by working-class African-Americans, almost every day. I don't think most of these cause actual problems of understanding in the courtroom, but I think they probably affected the jury's and certainly the public's ability to respect and believe her testimony and to relate to her. Relatability is very important.
Relatability. Well, actually, you did tell me that you thought it might have affected her testimony because there was one point where there was a misunderstanding about what she said.
Very, very crucial point. And one of the things that I think worried me a lot is the fact that the prosecution didn't make more of an effort to benefit from an interpreter. Now, of course, people might consider it, you know, ridiculous in some ways to have an interpreter for a person who spoke a deep dialect of American English. But there was a crucial point on the tape from the interview she had in April 2012 with Bernie de la Rionda, in which she said she heard someone saying, get off. And he said, but could you tell who was saying that? And the transcript reads, I couldn't know Trayvon or I couldn't hear Trayvon, none of which makes any semantic sense in context. But when you listen to it, those of us who were linguists who were listening to it, we heard it pretty clearly as I could, and it was Trayvon.
Well, Professor, I just want to pick up on what you've said, though, because you are saying that this is an African-American dialect, but there are many African-Americans who have said, I don't speak that way. I know, you know, anecdotally, an African-American mother who insists that her child not speak that way because she doesn't accept that there should be a different dialect for African-Americans. What do you say to people who say this reflects something else, a lack of willingness to speak the mainstream English, or that there shouldn't be different dialects for different people and interpreters for them at trials?
Yeah, but, you know, language can't really be legislated. Many of the same people who will make those critiques of what their children might speak. You see, African-American vernacular English is like a testament to the existence of difference. And many African-Americans themselves who are speakers of these varieties will say that to their kids and then use many of the features themselves. I mean, at the height of the Ebonics controversy, I remember one person saying, you know, ain't nobody here speaking no Ebonics. So you have to be careful to distinguish between features of the vernacular that are used just by younger people, more slang, like a lot of the use of the N-word in reference to friends and so on, is more characteristic of people beneath a certain age, and a lot of older people critique it. And then there are lots of other features of African-American English, like the use of the word kitchen for the hair at the back of the neck, you know, which tends to be more curly and kinky and so on and so
forth. What's the word?
And, you know, if somebody talks about their kitchen, they got to go to the hairdresser to try and get their kitchen looked after. Then they're talking about the hair at the back of the neck. And a lot of these features, you know, when she says things like, he a mama boy, he trying to get home. These are all excerpts from her testimony. Or he love his family. All those grammatical features, the absence of the possessive, the absence of auxiliary is, and he trying to get home, those are widespread throughout the African-American community.
By the way, is this a racial divide in language, or is it a cultural divide? In other words, are there pockets of America where lower-income whites have a different dialect?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Because people seem to agree that language is this, you know, profound mark of education and worth, then you can often beat up on it when you want to beat up on other aspects of people without fear of being criticized. Mm-hmm. So there are many things that Rachel Jean Tell represents, but she is herself a victim. This is her childhood friend. She knew him from kindergarten. And she's talking about what she heard. And instead, she's the one that's being put on trial, not only by the defense attorneys, but by all of America.
Professor, after the break, we're going to take up the use of the N-word. But I know you wanted to comment on the use of the word cracker.
Well, a couple things about the use of the word cracker. First of all, it's Dictionary of American Regional English shows very clearly that it's regionally restricted. So, you know, you hear it in Florida and in some surrounding southern states, South Carolina, Georgia, pretty much unknown among the general population in, you know, New York and many other parts of the country. I think there are 2 points to be made about creepy-ass cracker. The defense tried to suggest that she may have lied because in her earlier interview in 2012 with attorney Bernie de la Rionda, she hadn't actually used that word, which is true. She hadn't used that expression, but she did report that Trayvon said that the guy who was following her was white, and he said that the guy looked creepy. So it's not a big semantic leap from creepy white guy to creepy ass cracker. And it's particularly so because there's a whole grammar of ass words in African-American English showing that it's a part of, you know, uncensored speech, particularly among younger African-Americans. The words are not inherently negative or positive.
It sounds as if, as a linguist, you would strip away some of the words around that, and it's the word creepy that you might hear.
Oh, yes. As she said, for her, in this case, it meant pervert. You know, it's something that the guy is doing that causes some alarm.
That's John Rickford, professor of linguistics and humanities at Stanford University. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're talking about the national conversation that's been launched by a young Haitian-American woman named Rachel Jean Tell, who's testifying for the prosecution in the trial of George Zimmerman, who's accused of killing her childhood friend Trayvon Martin. Defense attorneys have also said they couldn't understand her, and much has been made of her using the N-word and the word cracker to quote Trayvon. Linguist John Rickford just told us that in Jean Tell's dialect, she's actually being grammatically accurate. And even her use of the word cracker in that dialect follows clear linguistic rules. But what about the cultural questions, especially since Paula Deen admitted using the N-word and said she was confused because she heard blacks using it? Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad is with us. He's the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. And Dr. Muhammad, first of all, what are you hearing specifically in this trial?
I am hearing the testimony of a 19-year-old, a teenager, someone who's finishing high school, talking about the tragedy of having lost a friend and being one of the few people who can testify to what Trayvon was experiencing at the moment that he was encountered by George Zimmerman. That's what I'm hearing.
Well, what do you make of the furor in social media? There are people who are obviously racist. That's happening. There are people who are also curious. You know, what are we hearing? They don't understand what they're hearing. And then I'm reading on some black blogs. Here's News One. There seems to be a divide within the black community. I'm reading a blogger who's saying there are the talented 10th black people who are voicing their disgust at this young woman's inability to code switch, to change her language for the trial. They're ridiculing her skin color, her weight, and her speech, even though Creole and Spanish are her first language. So there seem to be all sorts of corners from which this is being viewed.
Yeah, it's a very tricky landscape, yeah. Although it's always been tricky. And in some ways, these various responses from the racist to the confused to those articulating long-standing classist notions of a proper black person or proper black behavior are enduring problems in American culture. Problems only from the standpoint in that they get in the way of recognizing people's humanity. In other words, what's on trial here is the measure of justice, not the measure of her speech. And the notion that somehow she is articulating what happened in such a way that is surprising to people is no different than the trouble I have, Robin, with a strong Boston accent when I encounter it. Sometimes it's very difficult to navigate the regional accents and the dialects that exist in our culture. And it just seems that in this case, given this particular moment in trial, it's been blown out of proportion, that particular issue.
Well, and to talk more about within the black community, because I'm seeing a comment here from someone saying, it's tragic how quickly and with so much glee some black people are throwing our black youth under the bus. People are now ashamed of her. You've said that she's probably conscious that other blacks are viewing her in a certain way, and that's maybe adding to what we sometimes see as discomfort.
Yes, this is a kind of an everyday problem for some African Americans in their homes, in their communities. Oftentimes it comes up in the case of a local crime scene. Someone on the street is interviewed, and it happens to be a person whose formal education is at such a level that they don't speak what we might all call proper English. And I know John just talked about this, and I'm not weighing in on the debate, the normative value of whether that's good or bad, only to say that this observation of either ebonics or black language or inappropriate use of grammar in speaking causes a lot of shame within many African-American households when they watch this. And it's true even to black immigrant households where the need to show one's respectability is very intense. And so this assimilating into mainstream culture for black immigrants, be they Caribbean or African, is also predicated on this notion of how correctly you speak English. Yeah. So that this problem is a kind of an everyday occurrence. The difference here is that it has reached the national stage, given the Zimmerman trial and what it has meant for a generation of young people, be they millennials or Generation Y. This is their moment for being represented in an important national moment. And many people are criticizing this young woman because she's not living up to what should be a proper racial representation.
Well, and John McWhorter, the other linguist that we spoke of from Columbia, said that there's a lot of hypocrisy, too, because everybody has heard this language from formerly poor, now very wealthy hip-hop artists who are using it quite a bit, and it's being enjoyed by maybe some of the same people who are criticizing it now in this young woman. But I just want to get in. You compare this trial to the trial of the Scottsboro Boys. These were the 9 black teens accused of rape in Alabama in 1931 and found guilty. What's the connection?
Well, the connection is that for a group of young men ranging in age from 13 to 19, their class position, being the children of sharecroppers in Alabama in the 1930s, positioned them as being unworthy of representing the larger racial and class struggles of that period. And so the justice that was on trial, being falsely accused of raping two white women, was not sufficient for the standard bearer of the black middle class community, the NAACP at that time, to represent them for fear that essentially their own questionable class position was not a good representation of the race. And so they wait for another case. This also happened in the case of Claudette Colvin, who several months before Rosa Parks was in a position to be a lead plaintiff in the case to strike down segregation in Montgomery. Yeah. And there again, the NAACP thought after she was arrested, she subsequently ended up pregnant by the time of the trial. She was not a good poster representation of the race.
And Khalil Muhammad, I just want to get in. Obviously, there was also discussion of the N-word. Randall Kennedy wrote the terrific book on the N-word years ago, but does it boil down to, very, very briefly, does it just boil down to how you use it? I mean, if it's as a slur or as a casual word?
It matters in the same way that individuals inside their own homes get to call people what they want to call them. When you step out into the public, you don't get to say what you want to say.
Yeah.
And so in this case, that's what got Paula Deen in trouble.
Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at the New York Public Library. Thanks so much for weighing in.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, take a break. Latest news is next. Here and now